Well, good morning. All right, we are continuing on in Genesis, and we are in Genesis 34. We're leaving, we're going to leave today the end of one major section in Genesis, one of the toledotes, those genealogies. This is the history of, and we're going to move into the last one. God willing, today we'll beginning that with the person of Joseph. But we've left with Canaan, Jacob in Canaan. He's back in Canaan. He's returned from being with Uncle Laban for, you know, about 20 years, and now he's back in Canaan. And they've settled in the area of Shechem. And we see one of these really tragic scenes in the history of the Bible. In Genesis, there are several scenes that are just, there's no other way to describe it. They're just really gritty. They're ugly, all right? And Genesis 34 is one of those texts. We get another one here in a few chapters later when we have the issue of Judah and Tamar. The Bible is an honest book. It paints reality well. It shows us what we're really like. And this is an example of that. So we have Jacob and Canaan. They've settled in Shechem. And you see the title for this section is The Rape of Dinah. There's no other way to really talk about it. This is what happens here. So in general, if you don't remember the account, Jacob and his sons, they settle in this area, which if you followed what God told him to do, was not exactly what God told him to do. He was to go back to his family. He doesn't make it all the way to his family. He stops in Shechem. It's hard to know for sure whether that was an explicit violation of God's command. It seems to have some pretty negative consequences here. And the son of the king of Shechem, and the son's name is Shechem, ends up raping one of the sister of the brothers, Jacob's daughter. And ensuing from that, there is a conflict, obviously, and that conflict is resolved, so to speak, when several of the sons of Jacob go through the city and slaughter all the men. And they were able to do that because the king of Shechem and Shechem himself say to Jacob and his sons, let's fix this. We'll let our sons and daughters marry your sons and daughters. We'll build a kingdom together here that will work this out. We'll live together in peace and harmony, and everything will be fine. And the sons of Judah, or sons, excuse me, of Jacob, in essence, say, you know, that sounds like a great deal, but we're religious people, and we want you to do this one thing. We want all of your men to be circumcised. And if you agree to circumcision, We'll do this deal. And they had ulterior motives, though. All the men of the city were circumcised, and they're men, they're not babies here. And, you know, it's not hard to figure out that that is a painful process and leaves a lot of men very weak for a couple of days. And while they're weak, several of the sons of Jacob come in and slaughter all the men of the city, right? So that's the account in Genesis 34. It's an ugly account from every aspect, every angle that you can look at it. So let's just think about why that's here and what it means in the timeline of events here. You see there under letter A that we have that Jacob does stay for a lengthy time in Shechem. And as I mentioned, though, we cannot blame Jacob for Shechem's sin. Shechem is, again, the son of the king of Shechem. We cannot blame Jacob for Shechem's sin. The reader is led to think that Jacob should not have been there. It just seems that he was not where he was supposed to be. So this delay represented a, here's your first blanks, a serious threat to the promises of God. So Jacob's here too long, and this represents a serious threat to the promises of God. Because this could result in a war that would destroy the people of God. It could also result in the compromise that the people of Shechem wanted of intermarrying of the people of God. And that's going to cause trouble as well. So after Dinah is raped, Shechem desired to have her in his, as his wife. You see that in verse 3. You have this idiom there. It says that he spoke tenderly to her. And it's his desire there is to win her heart. Now, whether or not he actually was able to do that is unclear. But what is clear is that he did demand his father to get her as a wife. However, if you go down to verse number 26, it seems as if Dinah was being held against her will. So after the Simeon and Levi come in and slaughter the men of the city, it says this, and they killed Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. That phrase indicates probably that she was being held against her will there. Now, Jacob's response to all of this is kind of jarring. If you look in verse number 5, this is just nobody in this chapter comes out smelling good. Okay, I'll just say that. All right, nobody in this chapter comes out smelling and looking good. You look at Jacob, what he does in verse number 5, and this is after his own daughter has been raped and is probably being held against her will. Jacob sits there and holds his peace. He doesn't say anything. And his sons are a long ways away tending the flocks. And he does nothing. He just sits there. And that was not the right response. The sons, they come back, the sons of Jacob, they come back and they're rightfully angry. They're ticked. Like, how could we let this go on? So Hamor, that's Shechem's father, proposed that not only would his son take Dinah as a wife, but also that they would all intermarry. And this proposal, as I've already alluded to, would have compromised God's plan to have Jacob and his descendants possess the land. Furthermore, if you go down to verses 20 through 23, I don't think Hamor and Shechem were being completely upstanding citizens here. We know Shechem wasn't. So after this kind of deal is potentially brokered, it says this, and Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of the city and spoke with the men of their city, saying, "These men are at peace with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it, for indeed the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition, men will consent to be one people if the males are circumcised. Verse 23, will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours?" So they're thinking, this is a deal that we can make, and they will assimilate into us and will become very rich. And Jacob was rich. Remember when he left Padan Aram? He is a very, very wealthy man. And he has a massive household. 12 sons that are having children and probably lots of servants, huge amounts of herds and flocks. And so this for them is a way to possess all of that unto themselves. They'll assimilate here and this will work out well. But of course, from God's perspective and from our perspective, looking at what God's trying to do and bringing about the redemption and salvation of his people, this is a big problem. Because you can't have Israel, you can't have the people of God, of Abraham, gone. The promises of God need to be fulfilled through those people. So this is a serious threat. We should also take a step back and remind ourselves that as we think about, remember that the people who are first receiving the book of Genesis, these are the people that have left Egypt and they're about to enter the promised land. And do you think there were ever times where the people of Israel, the children of Israel, kind of thought fondly of being back in Egypt and thinking maybe it was better back there? Maybe we should have just stayed there and dwelt? And of course, the answer is yes, if you know your Bible. But that would have been a threat to God's redemptive purposes for Israel, for them to stay and to be assimilated into the land of Egypt. And so this account would remind them that, no, God wants us to be a distinct people. Now, the sons of Jacob, they're the ones who are addressed by Hamor as he makes this deal or offers this deal to them. Although the text is very clear that Shechem's actions were evil, Moses also indicates that the son's response was also evil. There's your blanks for letter A. The son's response was also evil in that they answered deceitfully in verse 13. They lied. And they lied by using religious practices, circumcision, which was the sign of the covenant that God had made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They lied by using that religious practice to indicate that they would be further disgraced and therefore cut off from the covenant of Abraham. Now, the sons of Jacob may have thought, it's hard to know whether they were kind of offering this as a deal to say, they're never going to accept this. It's like, somebody wants to buy a piece of property from you. You don't want to sell unless you offer them some ridiculously high price for the piece of property that nobody's going to pay. They're never going to accept that. That may have been what they were thinking. No city full of men is going to go, I'm going to sign up for this, right? Okay. I'm not signing up for that, just full disclosure, right? So, most of us guys aren't going to do that. So maybe that's what they were thinking. Or maybe they were hoping that they would take the deal and that they would have opportunity for this kind of slaughter. But nonetheless, whatever the case would be, the men of the city, they agree. And probably it was because of the wealth that they thought they could get. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, while the men of the city are recovering from circumcision, Levi and Simeon attack the city. They kill all the men of the city. And in the process, they rescue Dinah. Now, although this act rescued Dinah, it created another threat to God's promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jacob himself identifies this problem down in verse number 30. Notice what it says. And Jacob called to Simeon and Levi, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious," literally making me stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites, the Perizzites. "Since I am few in number, they will gather themselves against me, and I shall be killed, destroyed, my household. Everything is going to be gone." And that, by the way, is not an unreasonable worry by Jacob. Yet we know in reading, of course, the rest of the account and the rest of Genesis that God cared for Jacob and his household. Jacob's response in all of this is woefully poor. He never expresses concern for his daughter throughout the whole of these incidents. His concern was merely for the survival of his own household. Now, while the brothers' actions were not justified, they at least understood the seriousness of this situation. Now, you say, why in the world is this account here? Well, I think one of the reasons, as I mentioned already, is it encourages the people of Israel to realize that God was going to preserve them and God wanted to keep them distinct. That's one of the reasons. And so we see also in that, number three, the repeated themes of God's faithfulness to his promises, in spite of both the challenges made by the people around the patriarchs and the failures of the patriarchs themselves. So God's faithful even when people around us are unfaithful. God's faithful even when we are unfaithful. And all of that is on full display in this text. There may be something else here as well, and I don't have this in your notes. This is a little more speculative, but I think it fits overall in the theme of the Bible and also of Genesis as well. And that is that we are reminded again that the patriarchs were not chosen by God because they were good people. Right? They're just not chosen by God because they're good people. We've already seen failures with Abraham. We've seen them with Isaac. We've seen them with Jacob. And now we've seen them with his 12 sons. And we're going to see more of that when we get to the life of Joseph and they throw him in a pit and sell him as a slave. So they're not chosen because they're good people. That would also help us to think that when the people of Israel getting ready to cross over into Canaan to possess the land, they should never have had some sort of air of superiority. Like we're somehow great people coming and getting this land. The only reason they would ever have the right to possess that land is because God gave it to them. Not because they were so good. In fact, you remember as Moses preaches to the people of Israel in Deuteronomy right before he's going to pass off the scene, he says explicitly to them, "The Lord does not set his love upon you because you are a great people or a mighty people or a noble people. You're not a moral people. You're a stiff-necked, hard-hearted people." I'm paraphrasing, but those are the kinds of things that he says to them. Yet God loves you and says, "Here, this is all yours." And so this account would have given the people of Israel a great deal of humility. We don't get this because we're so great. So a gritty account, ugly account, but has some powerful lessons, not only for the people of Israel, but I think for us as well. Well, we move on. We're still in the life of Jacob, although properly speaking, this is under the genealogy, the Toledot, the history of Isaac. And we see that Jacob moves on from Shechem with his sons. Genesis 35 through 36 marks the end of the focus of the narrative being upon Jacob. Jacob is going to appear a number of times, but the text from after you finish Genesis 35 is going to focus on Jacob's sons primarily here on forward. Here in chapters 35 and 36, there are a number of events, five of them specifically, that either point the reader forward, backward, or tie themes of what comes before and after in Jacob's life. You have Jacob at Bethel, or Bethel, Rachel's death, that's one of his wives, Reuben's great sin, Jacob's sons, and the death of Isaac. What that means is that chapters 35 and 36 are largely transitional in nature. Well, we read that Jacob is going to leave in Genesis 35. He's going to get his family out of there, and he's going to do so because God tells him to do this. So verse 1 of Genesis 35, God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. Live there. Make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." Jacob and his family may have been in danger after the slaughter of the man of Shechem. That's what Jacob's worried about at the end of Genesis 34. But now God commands him to go to this place. Jacob had been there 20 years earlier, Bethel. That's the place where the Lord appeared to him in that vision with the angels ascending and descending upon the ladder up into heaven. That's this place. Bethel means house of God, the place of God. And so he's commanded to go there. It is interesting to note that before he goes, Jacob gives this command in verses 2, 3, and 4. So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel so that I may make an altar there to worship, or to altar to God who answers me in the day of my distress." Verse 4, "So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods that they had, the rings that were there in their ears. Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree that was near Shechem." So before he goes, Jacob gives these commands, and you see this at the end of that paragraph. Each of these were markers of being set apart. That's number two, or number, letter A under subsection 2, set apart for the worship of God. But of course, the shocking part of this is that it included putting away foreign gods. In fact, that's probably even a little bit of what the reference to the earrings were. God isn't against earrings, but these were probably pagan markers that were making them look like the people of the pagan idolatrous culture around them. So you have this going on. So what in the world does this mean? Well, when you think about the foreign gods, this would have at least included the gods that Rachel had stolen from Laban, but probably included others as well. And this is a reminder that idolatry was a constant temptation for Israel. It's a constant temptation for Israel from its early days. And again, this is a powerful lesson for the people of Israel. They're coming out of Egypt. Put away all of that stuff. Devote yourself wholly to the Lord. Now, God's protection in verse 5 is evident. As they go on this journey, there's a terror that falls upon the cities around them. Remember, Jacob is worried that they're going to be assaulted, they're going to be beat up, they're going to be attacked on their way. We've been obnoxious, we've been made to stink in the land, but God protected them. So nobody came after the sons of Jacob. In this transition point, we see these as some transition markers. Also in verse number 8, we read about the death of Deborah. That's Rebekah's nurse. That probably indicated that Rebekah had already died, Rebekah being Jacob's mother. It's possible that Deborah had been sent to Jacob after the death of his mother. Moses does not state anything about Rebekah's death, but her burial place is stated in Genesis 49:31. So So Jacob probably knew about his mother's death before entering back into Canaan. So this is a marker in the text to say there are transitions coming here in how God is working and in time. Well, as Jacob is at Bethel, God appears to him again in verse 9, and then God changes his name to Israel. And then we have a powerful reaffirmation of the covenant promises of God to Jacob. We don't have time to do this, but it's worth seeing that there are strong links to the way that God affirms his covenant promises to Jacob and to what God had already affirmed to Abraham. And you can see those verses there in Genesis 17, 1 through 8. The link between the two passages is made clear by the use of the name God Almighty. God Almighty. You see that here in verse number 11 in this chapter, chapter 35. And God said to him, I am God Almighty. That's the name that God revealed himself to when he spoke to Abraham. That was loud. All right. So we're moving on. And you see these kind of things building. You've got Deborah has died, which probably indicates that Rebecca, Jacob's mother, has died. And now we see another death in the family, and that's of Rachel. Rachel being the second of Jacob's wives. She dies. We read about that in verses 16 through 20. And she dies in childbirth. We are not told that she was pregnant, but she obviously was. And she gives birth to a son. And she is recognizing that she is dying as she gives birth to her son. So she gives the name of her son as Ben-Oni, which means son of my pain. Not exactly a strong name for a son. And Jacob doesn't appreciate that. Instead, he says to her, we're going to name him Benjamin, Ben-Yamin, which means son of my right hand. Son of my right hand. Now, it's interesting that the text says this in verse number 20. She's died. They bury her. Jacob set a pillar over her tomb. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. And that probably was significant for the people of Israel as they're crossing over into the promised land. This was a powerful reminder. That tomb, this was the place where our forefathers were at. This is the place that God has given to us. And there's this emphasis again and again that the patriarchs wanted themselves and their family to be buried in the land of promise. Because this was the land that God was giving us. So this was another marker of that. Well, then we come to, this is very briefly mentioned, but another ugly episode in the life of the sons of Judah, or excuse me, sons of Jacob, and that is of Reuben's great sin, Reuben's great sin. It's simply stated, and I'll just read it. It says, Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder while Israel lived in that land, Israel being Jacob. Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12, and then we get the list of their names. It's just briefly mentioned here that Reuben sleeps with his father's concubine. This is a pretty serious and disgusting act. Reuben's incest with her was likely not merely an act of lust. It was an attempt to usurp the authority and power of Jacob. And I've given you several other examples in the Old Testament of people who tried to do this. So Reuben was the firstborn, and this was a slap in his father's face in many ways. Now again, we talked about this. Jacob has two wives, he has two concubines, not good. The text doesn't explicitly condemn that, but all the way through these narratives, it makes it very clear this is not what God intended, it's not good, and it creates problems. And here's one of the problems here. And so this was a big slap in his father's face. This offense would be serious for Reuben, as the firstborn, he would not receive the double blessing. Firstborn sons were destined to inherit a double blessing from the father. And I've tried to remind that to my brothers and sisters in the past, but they don't buy that. Apparently that custom is gone. But in the Old Testament era, that was the case. And Reuben is not going to get that. He's not going to get that. In fact, if you go to Genesis 49, when Jacob is dying, he doesn't even give any blessing to Reuben.
2 times 0 is 0, by the way.
2 times 0 is 0. Oh, yes. Yeah. He got nothing, right? Yeah.
Well, I'm just talking about you.
Okay. Well, No. My brother-in-law is here today. So I forgot to mention that. I was going to do that at the beginning, by the way. So this is Pastor Toby Fleming. He's a pastor at Beverly Community Church in Beverly, Kansas, which is even more in the middle of nowhere than Sunrise. I think that's probably fair to say.
Oh, by far.
Okay. But he's got a whole host of young people that stayed last night in the church building and tonight, and then they're going to Camp Shatek on Monday. So we're thankful that they're here. So don't tell him. Toby will whisper that in my sister's ear, and it'll be a problem. So all right. So he's gonna lose this. He's gonna get absolutely nothing out of this. So it's a disaster for Reuben. But more than that, it's a disaster for the family. So this account is another way that Moses and God uses the narrative here to demonstrate that polygamy was a disaster for families. And as we noted earlier, the narrative shows that this behavior has sorrowful consequences for families. Pain upon pain upon pain. And it just keeps showing up in this family. And we're going to see it even more with Joseph and the brothers. Finally, also, I think this is an indictment against Jacob as well. You see the same kind of response that he had towards Dinah. You see this at the end of verse 22. It just says, now Israel heard about it. He didn't say anything about it. He didn't do anything about it. Just heard it. And this is the second time that he's done this. Now, Jacob doesn't forget about it because he deals with it on his deathbed in Genesis 49. But he doesn't do anything about it. Another act of transition here, we see the list of Jacob's sons. This is the list. This list reflects the order of Exodus 1, but it's not the order of the sons mentioned in Genesis 46, 8 through 26. So you'll note there are some differences there, but all 12 sons are mentioned in both of those lists. Finally, in this transition period, we have Isaac's death. We see this at the end of chapter 35. Isaac breathes his last. He's gathered his people. And according to verse 28, he lived 180 years. Now, when we see this mentioned here at the end of Genesis 35, Isaac is actually still alive when you continue to read on from Genesis 36. This is just a narrative way, a literary way of showing that there's a major transition here. Because if you do a deep dive on the chronology, if Isaac lived 180 years, he likely lived long enough to see the selling of Joseph into slavery, though he would not have known that Joseph was sold into slavery. So sometimes authors do this, and we have the same thing today. If you read a good history book, you know, it might, you know, kind of on a one chapter run down the life of someone and bring their life to a close, even though they're continuing to live on because their influence on the story is not significant any longer. So that's what's happening here. But again, this shows in these chapters that there's a transition happening now from Isaac to Jacob and eventually to Jacob's sons. So Isaac passes off the scene. It's also interesting to note that there are many parallels to the death of Abraham in Genesis 25, which demonstrates the continuity of the promises of God to the patriarchs. And again, you can do that comparison on your own time. For the people of Israel reading this, they would have caught it very easily. Now we get to Esau. And we have this phrase that we've seen in Genesis over and over in chapter 36, verse 1. Now this is the genealogy, that's that word toledot, of Esau. This is the shortest of the major sections. And you have Esau being mentioned with his children and sons and daughters. The primary reasons for this section being here are twofold, or several fold. It helps us to explain where one of the sons of Isaac settled. The land that the Israelites were preparing to cross belonged to the descendants of Esau. It also helped to explain that the chosen line was Jacob, not Esau. And also let her see that Esau received what he deserved. Edom means red. Moses mentions four times that Esau is Edom. And repeating this theme would remind the readers of the soup Esau had taken in exchange for his birthright. Most of you probably don't remember this who were here, and a lot of you weren't here, but way back in 2017, I actually preached through the life of Joseph, and we spent a whole sermon dealing with Genesis 36. And I introduced that sermon by saying, some portions of the Bible are like parents when they say to you, eat your vegetables, because they're good for you. And Genesis 36 is kind of like that. If you read through it quickly, if you're doing your devotions and you're one of the people that like to read all the way through the Bible in a year, you get to texts like this, and if we're honest, oftentimes our eyes are kind of just going really fast through these names and lists and stuff. We're not actually thinking really seriously about them. And in one sense, there's nothing wrong with that, because I don't think there are great significances attached to every one of the names that are listed in a genealogy like this. But in this case, there are actually theological reasons why Moses lists this. And we'll talk about them a little bit more. I've kind of introduced it already here with Esau. So there are reasons why this is here. This isn't just filler space to try to just kill time. Paper was expensive, so Moses didn't write this accidentally. There are reasons for this. Now, we have this statement, these are the generations, this is the history of Esau, and then you actually have the same thing again. There's another toledot mentioned in verse number 9. So we have the family of Esau again. Esau and his sons, we see in verses 9 through 19, the leaders of the Edomites. This second toledot speaks of Esau and his position as leader of a new people. And if you look carefully, you're going to note that this second genealogy differs slightly from the first one, in that it emphasizes Esau as the father of the Edomites and emphasizes their location, Mount Seir. And the implication here is that Esau's grandsons, were born in Seir. We also learn about the people that were at Seir. It was the Horites, and you read about them in verses 20 through 30. The organization of these clans is parallel to that of the Edomites. There are three generations that are mentioned. So you have Esau, his sons, and his grandsons mentioned. Now you have these people who were at Seir, the Horites, the father, son, and grandsons that are mentioned. And verse 20 explains why these were mentioned. These were the ones who inhabited the land that Esau displaced. So Esau, he moves into this region and pushes out over time these people. Now I'm going to explain in a minute why I think this is significant and why I think Moses has this here, but just note that's what's kind of going on here. I'm not going to read through all the names. They're too hard to pronounce. You can do that in yourself or pretend you know what you're talking about. Most of us don't when you try to pronounce some of these names. But you have all these people mentioned, but there's parallels going on. So you got Esau, his three generations, you've got the Horites, their three generations, Esau's coming in, and over time, they're being assimilated and pushed out. That's in essence what's happening here. Then you also have there in chapter 36, verses 31 through 43, a list of the kings and the chiefs of the Edomites. Now, this will be a little bit challenging for us to think through, but this list is likely an addition after Moses during the time of the reigns of David or Solomon. If you read almost every Bible commentator, they're going to tell you that, and I'm in agreement with them. During the reign of David, he subdued the Edomites. You can read about that in 2 Samuel 8:12. He did not eradicate them, but he brought them under his authority. Solomon also possessed the land of Edom. They became sort of a vassal state underneath his kingship and Solomon's kingship. So you notice this in the text that it says this in this list here of the kings in verse 31, that it says, before any king reigned over the children of Israel. That is a tell, it's a marker to indicate this was added sometime after Moses. Now that might cause some people a little bit of consternation as to wondering, how does that work with the inspiration of the scriptures? And I'm not going to fully answer that, except to say that way back in the beginning of our study, we talked about how the final form of the Pentateuch was probably not finished until the time of Solomon, maybe even up to Ezra. Okay, so this doesn't do any injustice to how God planned to bring about the scriptures here. There are updates clearly of things like spelling and place names, because Moses is writing this, you know, roughly around 1430 BC. And Ezra, he's 500 BC. So you've got almost 1,000 years in there. And if you just think about what happens to language and place names over 1,000 years, Ezra the scribe was given the task by God to bring together the Old Testament canon and update it. He does that. Probably this is a reference to that. Another reason why that we think this is probably a later addition, this list is also found in 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verses 43 through 54. This list in general, you say, why was it added here? It emphasizes Isaac's blessing on Esau that he would live by the sword, but that he would serve his younger brother. You can read that in Genesis 27:40. Now you get to Genesis 37:1, and we get the transition back to the elect line. But let's just think about real briefly, and then we need to be done, about the significance of Esau. The two toledotes, that's that word for genealogy, or this is the history of, remember, told the Israelites who their neighbors were as they entered the promised land. These two sections about Esau also, more importantly, demonstrate that Esau despised his birthright. Now, you might not get that right away, but if you read real carefully and you got to think from the mindset of those first readers, there's a really significant thing that happens in here, in that Moses emphasizes that Esau moved to Mount Seir. Mount Seir was not in the area that God had said this is the land of promise. By moving in this way, Esau showed that he had no real desire to claim the land of promise as his own. Remember when he sold his birthright for the pot of stew, the soup, right? What this text is showing is by his actions, even as he quote-unquote matured, he was still not thinking in terms of God's covenant blessings. I don't really care about the land of promise that was given to my forefathers. I'll go elsewhere. Can you think, if you think about Genesis, can you think of any other significant character in Genesis who also moved away from the land of a promise to a troubling location, and that it didn't end up well for him and his family? Lot. That's exactly it. In fact, if you're reading through this, and you got to think, like, you're reading through this narrative, the parallels would be flying in your mind, right? This was a bad decision by Esau. And furthermore, even with the Horites, there seems to be this idea, it's implied, that Esau intermarried with these people and probably took on some of their evil things. Remember when we're first introduced to Esau, what is he known for with his choice of wives? He marries two Canaanite women. And so all of this is coming together to say Esau was a man who despised his birthright. Now, I've just got a couple other quick notes that are not in your notes, but they are worth thinking about. From the perspective of the readers of Genesis, the Edomites were the ones who refused to let Israel pass through their land. So you read about that later in the Pentateuch. And yet God would say in Deuteronomy 23:7 that the Israelites should not abhor the Edomite, for he is your brother. There's another interesting thing that happens, and again, this is not in your notes, is that one of the descendants of Esau is a man named Amalek. Anybody remember who that turns out to be? He is the father of the Amalekites. They were a terrible thorn in the side of the people of Israel. They're the ones that actually not only said, you can't pass through our land on the way to the promised land, but we will attack you. That's the account where Moses has to hold up his hands during the battle to allow the people of Israel to prevail. And it's Aaron and Joshua, right? They come and they support him so that they will prevail in the battle. The Amalekites continue to show up all the way, even until the time of 1 and 2 Samuel. We read about them. Remember, Saul was commanded to go attack the Amalekites. And they're going to show up even further in that when you get to the time of Esther, who's the bad guy?
Haman.
Haman was probably a descendant from the Amalekites and was still trying to eradicate the people of Israel. And so this text is saying Esau's a bad guy. It's not just that God chose Jacob, it's also that Esau chose bad things. And the results of this is terrible throughout the history of his family. And finally, I'll just say that reading this from a New Testament perspective, we recognize that David's conquering of Edom foreshadows the greater conquest that David's greater son, the Lord Jesus, will make when he rules over the nations of the earth. So this section in here, it's kind of dry sawdust, vegetables, kind of a feeling. But actually, there are theological and practical things being explained if we're careful readers. Any real quick questions that we have about this? We've covered a lot of ground here this morning. We'll get to Joseph. I was hoping to get to Joseph today. We'll get to him next week. Yes, sir.
Just a question on Bethlehem is of Ephrathah. Is there another Bethlehem that is distinguishing itself from?
With Bethel, you're saying?
No, Bethlehem, wasn't it? Of Ephrata, that was about midway through your talk today.
Did I mention
Bethlehem, didn't you?
Did I say Bethel?
No, Bethel.
I said Bethel. Bethel, yeah, I was going to say. Yes, Bethel is Bethel or Betel in Hebrew. Bet or Beit is house. L of God. So that's probably what I meant to say.
Well, yeah, no, you said that, but you said, I thought there was, I'll look it up in the notes, Ephrathah or Ephraim?
I don't remember.
Anyway, I'll look it up and ask you later.
Anything I say and can say can be used against me. All right, you are dismissed. We'll get ready for the morning worship service.